Well, we began this morning's sermon by noting an apparent contradiction. Amos's announcements of what is going to happen to Syria and what is going to happen to Philistia and what is going to happen to Tyre and so on, they seem to be at odds with the book's opening statement that Amos's prophecy is concerning Israel. It just doesn't seem to add up. That's what the book's supposed to be. It's concerning Israel, and yet immediately he's prophesying about all these other nations. And we're going to open then this evening's sermon by noting another apparent contradiction. So Paul's exhortation in verse 31 of chapter 12, earnestly desire the higher gifts, that seems to be at odds with one of his arguments in the preceding verses. One of his arguments against this Corinthian preoccupation with speaking in tongues. He has argued in that connection that there are lots of gifts which are equally from the Holy Spirit, and it's wrong, therefore, to put a premium on one of the Spirit's gifts and to consider that more special than others. That's what he has argued. Now, however, in this verse, in verse 31, he seems to be saying the opposite. He seems to be saying here that the Spirit's gifts aren't uniform in their value, that it's possible to identify some as higher gifts of the Spirit. And again, then, this doesn't seem to add up. The stress in, for instance, verses 4 to 11 on this gift being from the Spirit and that gift from the Spirit and the next gift being from the Spirit, and that they're all then the Spirit's gifts. Treat them all as such, and yet now, oh, some, he seems to be saying, are actually superior to others. Well, let me explain then what's happening here. Paul's attack on this Corinthian obsession that we've talked about repeatedly, this Corinthian obsession with the gift of speaking in tongues, it has begun gently. Remember, we've said several times, Paul in chapter 12 has really been painting with broad brushstrokes. And yes, it has emerged then already that the Corinthians' obsession, it's unhelpful. Remember, that was the first thing. It's wrong. It's theologically wrong. That was the second thing. And it's divisive. Those three things have certainly emerged in chapter 12, but they have done so without Paul ever having to be too confrontational. He hasn't been all that direct yet in this attack on their obsession. Now, however, he starts, as it were, to turn the screw somewhat on these Corinthians. Now he begins the more direct and the more radical arguments that he will pursue throughout chapter 14. And it's this then. It isn't just that speaking in tongues is not superior to the other gifts of the Spirit. They think it is. They think it's the gift. It's the top of the pile. Paul wants to say now, it's not just that speaking in tongues is not superior to the other gifts of the Spirit. Actually, he wants to say now, it's inferior. It's an inferior gift. And it's inferior because it has an inherent disadvantage about it. It has a built-in flaw. It doesn't automatically fulfill the basic purpose of a spiritual gift. Remember, we saw 2 weeks ago, the basic purpose of a spiritual gift is set forth in verse 7. I said this is a very important verse for this whole section of 1 Corinthians. Verse 7, to each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. You have a spiritual gift, Paul is saying there, for one reason and one reason alone. And that is in order to serve and to help and to bless others. That is the sole reason for gifts of the Spirit. They are for the good of others. But you see, the thing with speaking in tongues is that it's not actually guaranteed to do that. It's not guaranteed to help and serve and bless anyone. It will only do so if something else also happens. An utterance in a tongue is not by itself going to bless anyone. It will only be a blessing to someone else if there's this additional thing takes place, namely it's interpreted. If there's somebody else around who has a gift of interpretation and is able then to interpret that utterance. If that doesn't happen, then the utterance in the tongue is useless. It cannot possibly function for the common good if others can't understand it. It cannot be for their good if it's incomprehensible to them. And in that case then, the spiritual gift is useless. It's like a car that doesn't get you from A to B. It's like a Hoover that doesn't pick up rubbish from the carpet. It's like a camera that doesn't take pictures. A spiritual gift that isn't actually doing anyone else any good. It's utterly, utterly useless. And there's always that risk then associated with this gift of speaking in tongues. There's always this possibility that it will fail to meet the basic purpose of a spiritual gift. There's this unreliability about it. Yes, if there's someone on hand who can interpret it, fine, it will meet that purpose. But if there's not, it won't. That's the problem. That's the flaw. That's the Achilles heel with this gift. And so, Paul says, far from being superior, he's going to argue, it's actually an inferior gift. And that's what he means then when he says in verse 31, earnestly desire the higher gifts. He's not suggesting here that there's some whole complex league table of spiritual gifts. And he's saying, look, you know, try and aim for those that are in kind of the top four or five. At worst, those that are mid-table. Don't go for any that are down in the basement area of the league table. That's not what he's saying. His point is that there's one inferior gift, and that is speaking in tongues for the reason I just outlined. All the others are the higher gifts. Desire any of them, I think Paul is saying. Any of them more than this one, it's inferior because of this built-in disadvantage. Now, as I say, then, this is a radical development. Well, might not be for us, but for these Corinthians, this is a radical development in Paul's argument, in Paul's treatment of this whole theme, and it's calculated then to leave them reeling, to leave them utterly shocked. And that explains why, having said there in verse 31, earnestly desire the higher gifts, before he continues in that vein, before he continues to develop that in chapter 14, we have this kind of interlude through chapter 13. You see, if the Corinthians are going to appreciate the inferiority of speaking in tongues, as we said, they are going to have to appreciate verse 7, that gifts are for the common good. But if they are going to appreciate verse 7, that gifts are for the common good, they are going to have to appreciate something even more fundamental. Namely, the absolute, all-controlling importance of love. Why should spiritual gifts have as their raison d'être the good of others? Why shouldn't spiritual gifts be self-serving? Why not? Because of love, Paul says. Love is the reason why. And in this interlude then, throughout chapter 13, he goes right back to basics and he talks to them about this thing, love. And he does three things then. First of all, in this passage, he envisages love's absence. He envisages love's absence. So you notice that in the second half of verse 31, he introduces love, and in the ESV, and I think probably in most of the versions, he does so in these terms, a still more excellent way. But it's more literally a way beyond comparison. That's how he describes love. It's the same phrase that he uses in 2 Corinthians 4:17, where he says this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. And it's the same phrase that he uses here in this verse. Love is this way, this path that is beyond comparison. In other words, then, nothing else in the lives of God's people can compare with love. That's what he's saying. It's the supreme thing in the lives of God's people. And he develops that then in verses 1 to 3 of chapter 13 by, as I say, envisaging love's absence. So this past week it was the Nobel Prize ceremony in Stockholm. And at the point then when they were dealing with the Nobel Prize in Literature, there was a distinguished professor that came on stage commending this year's winner, and there was a notable artist who performed some of the work of this year's winner, and there was rapturous applause from the audience for this year's winner. But all of that really felt rather hollow and unsatisfying. Why? Well, because, of course, this year's winner himself wasn't there. No one really knows why or where he is, but he wasn't there. And no amount then of distinguished professors and notable artists and rapturous applause could make up for Bob Dylan's absence. And similarly then, in the life of the Christian, Paul is saying, you can have speaking in the tongues of men and of angels. He's talking there about the gift of speaking in tongues. We've touched in an earlier session on this connection with angels, perhaps touch on that again later on. But he's saying then that gift of speaking in tongues, so prized by the Corinthians, it can't make up for love's absence. In the life of the Christian, he goes on to say, you can have prophetic powers and great understanding and knowledge. Understanding and knowledge, they are closely related, I think, here and later on in chapter 14, to the gift of prophecy. As we shall see, really, this is what distinguishes prophecy from speaking in tongues. The one speaking in tongues doesn't understand, doesn't know what he is saying. The prophet does. He also goes on there to mention the same breath, faith. Faith so as to remove mountains. This is probably, again, a reference to faith, the gift of faith. Remember, I distinguish between normal faith that is a basic requirement of all Christians. It is by faith we are saved. There is that faith that is normative, that every Christian must exercise. But then there is the gift of faith that Paul lists there earlier on in chapter 12. And we said, then that is something different. It is not something all Christians have. Like all the gifts, they are distributed amongst Christians, and this faith is too. And Paul here then uses a very extreme example, faith that causes a mountain to be removed, and probably he is being there hyperbolic and exaggerative, but we used the example before from James 5, didn't we, of an illness being healed, and God then giving this faith to someone that another person's illness is going to be healed. And we said, you meet people who have these very strong convictions. Sometimes they prove to be wrong and they're hunches, but But on other occasions, it seems that perhaps it is a God-given conviction, a special faith given in this way. But the point here then is Paul is saying all of that then, prophetic powers, understanding, knowledge, faith that can even remove mountains, none of that can make up for love's absence. Well, then he goes on in verse 3 that even the willingness then to relinquish everything, whether it be one's possessions, that seems to be what he's talking about in the first part of the verse, or whether it be even one's life. And by the way, I think the footnote reading is to be preferred there in verse 3, not if I deliver up my body to be burned, but if I deliver up my body that I may boast. That seems more likely. And probably then he's not thinking of bad boasting, the kind of boasting that the Corinthians often did, but of good boasting, the kind of boasting that he did. You know how in the second letter to the Corinthians, he has that whole section where he's boasting, but he's boasting in a very counterintuitive way. He's boasting in weaknesses. And that's probably the sort of boasting he's talking about here, the sort of boasting that he does, boasting in his trials and sufferings and weaknesses. But again, he's saying even all of that can't make up for love's absence. And so it's a very striking paragraph, isn't it, those first three verses. I mean, as we keep saying in this whole section of the letter, he's playing down speaking in tongues, so you kind of expect that first thing he says in this paragraph. You expect him to say, if I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, I'm a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. That doesn't surprise us. But that even prophecy, which he speaks of very highly elsewhere, that even that can't make up for love. Even sacrificially giving up your possessions, your life for the cause of Christ, even that can't make up for love. These are things that Paul speaks of so highly elsewhere, and yet, no, they can't make up for love's absence. That's how important, that's how central, that's how indispensable love is. So that's the first thing he does then. He envisages love's absence. Secondly, he exhibits love's attitudes. He exhibits love's attitudes. And this is the next paragraph, verses 4 to 7. And in these verses then, he, as I say, exhibits what love is composed of, the attitudes that comprise love. He sets them out. It's not, of course, comprehensive, but it's a beautiful list, isn't it, of love's attitudes. And I suppose, like so many of these great classical, lyrical Bible passages, it almost seems that you detract from their poetic beauty when you try to expound them. There's not a great deal that you can say about such a paragraph. But perhaps we can say from verses 4 to 7, we can perhaps summarize that love is the overcoming of four factors at least that are kind of built into our fallen human nature. There are four factors built into our fallen human nature, and love is the overcoming of those. So, number one, ambition. Ambition. What is that? Ambition is the desire to be first, isn't it? It's this preoccupation with one's own interests. And love then is overcoming that ambition that is native to all of us as fallen human beings. That comes across in at least two of the items there early on in verse 4. Love does not envy. So as ambitious human beings, we envy what others have. Love doesn't, Paul says. Love doesn't boast. As ambitious human beings, we want others to notice us and think well of us and We want to have a big reputation. We want eminence. Love doesn't boast. That's the first thing. Love must overcome ambition. Secondly, it overcomes cynicism. Cynicism, that's another kind of built-in flaw of us fallen human beings. I mean then that expecting the worst of others. And love then overcomes that. Again, a couple of items there at the end in verse 7, that love believes all things and love hopes all things. And obviously there's a fine line here, and easily I suppose this can become naivety and gullibility, but perhaps naivety and gullibility are sometimes preferable to cynicism. And that's the thing that love overcomes, that sense of, oh, this person will never improve, this person cannot get any better, this person cannot change from what they are. That's cynicism, expecting the worst of others. But love looks for improvement, looks for change, looks for sanctification, looks for progress and growth in others, hopes for it, wants it, believes that it may happen. That's love overcoming cynicism. Thirdly, love overcomes revenge. Another thing built into us fallen human beings, this desire to settle scores, to get even with those who have hurt us, mistreated us in some way. And this, I think, is perhaps stressed more than anything else actually in the paragraph. And there's almost a kind of bracketing effect going on, that the paragraph begins, love is patient. It ends, love endures all things. And probably then both of those pointing to this ability of love to overcome hurt and to endure it and be patient in the face of provocation. Or then love is not irritable in verse 5 there, or easily angered would be another way of rendering that, or resentful. So again, someone wrongs you, and I suppose those are two alternative but both unhealthy reactions when someone wrongs you. You can just kind of erupt easily angered, or you can perhaps not erupt, but just bear a grudge, resenting what that person has done. Love overcomes this temptation for revenge, whether it's in whichever way it is, whether in the erupting sense or in the grudge-bearing sense. Or then again, in the last verse, love bears all things, pointing to the same reality, bears wrongs, bears abuses and hurts. And then fourthly, a fourth factor love must overcome, what I'm going to call perversity. Just those base instincts that are there in us as fallen human beings, whereby we have a taste for the wrong things, basically. Just that distortedness of our moral compass. And so he says then that love isn't rude at the start of verse 5. Perhaps thinking of the same kind of thing that he talks about in Ephesians 5, verse 4, where he says, let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead let there be thanksgiving. And we have then just these base instincts that will, if unchecked, will take us into rude, filthy thinking and conversation, Paul is saying. But love overcomes that. Love triumphs over that. Love isn't rude. Or then again, he says at the beginning of verse 6, it doesn't rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. And again, we just have this base instinct, don't we, to enjoy a juicy bit of scandal. Someone falls into sin, and sometimes we can even find ourselves relishing that and deriving some pleasure from that. Love doesn't. Love overcomes that perversity within us. And love rejoices in truth, in goodness, in moral beauty, not in wrongdoing.
And so this is Paul's exhibition then of love's attitudes. And as I say, I think we can sum it all up in that fourfold way, that love is overcoming ambition, and love is overcoming cynicism, and love is overcoming revenge, and love is overcoming perversity. So he envisages love's absence, he exhibits love's attitudes, but then thirdly in this passage, he explains love's advantage. He explains love's advantage. Why is this thing then that he's just displayed, he's just exhibited in verses 4 to 7, why is it so beyond comparison, as he's put it? Why is it the supreme thing? Why is it better than everything else? Why is it better than speaking in the tongues of men and angels? Better than prophesying? Better even than sacrificially relinquishing all your possessions? Why is love so important? Why are those other things so hollow and unsatisfying when love is absent? Why is love better than them all? Well, he tells us in the last part of the passage then, and in fact in that opening sentence there in verse 8, it sums it all up. Love never ends. And he's not there talking at the kind of personal microcosmic level and saying that a person's love for others never ends. I think sometimes it's understood in that way. That's not what he means. He means there will always be love. Love is an eternal virtue. Love is an eternal reality. Love will never pass away. It doesn't have any expiry date. There will always be love. And you see, he mentions then, doesn't he, in verse 8, these different gifts, and they are then these revelatory gifts, I think, prophesying, tongues, I've hinted before, I think that is a revelatory gift, and we'll see that more when we come to chapter 14. Knowledge, as I mentioned earlier on tonight, I think that's closely associated with prophesying. And so these are revelatory gifts, gifts by which God reveals, God speaks to his people. And he's saying then that they will pass away. The day is coming when they will no longer be necessary. When is that? Well, he's talking about the end. At the end of history, when this world is over, then those gifts will no longer be necessary. We will not need to know God immediately anymore, a knowledge mediated through anything, because we will know God immediately. That's what Paul is saying. He uses those two analogies, doesn't he, as he continues. The analogy of a child who then matures to be an adult and thinks differently. No longer thinks in childish ways. When I was growing up, my father, as you know, was a pastor. And as a young child, then I didn't seem to have much idea of what that meant, what the content of that was. My father, he also used to have a bookstall for the church that he would hold in Thirst Marketplace on a Monday. And one day at school, I was very young, and we were talking about jobs and what our parents did, and we were asking what our parents did, and I put my hand up and said, well, my father, he's a market stall man. That's his job, he runs a market stall. And on the strength of that, he then had to come into school to speak about his work as a market stall holder, when in fact he was a pastor. But it was my childish way of thinking. And Paul is using that as an analogy then, and he's saying that all our knowledge now then of God, it's childish compared to the knowledge we will have of God then in that world to come. Now it's immediate, now it's fuzzy, it's clouded, it's obscure, there's all these imperfections. Now our ideas of what God is like are a bit like my ideas of what my father was doing during the day. But then our ideas of God will be so clear and so different. Then the other analogy he uses is of the mirror compared to face to face. And this perhaps doesn't seem particularly helpful to us, but I think we need to remember that in first century Corinth, the mirror was really the only image form of a person's face that you'd see. We're surrounded by images. We see photos everywhere, but of course there were no photos. And so the only kind of image of someone you'd have that wasn't actually their real, that you weren't actually looking directly into their face, was in a mirror. And I think that's the point that Paul is saying, our views of God now, it's like we're seeing an image of him. But then we will see him face to face. And you know yourselves then, you meet someone and they ask you about your children or about your husband or wife, and you perhaps get a photo out and show them. And you perhaps say to them, well, that doesn't really do justice. Because a picture never does, however good the picture is, however brilliantly taken it was by the photographer, however good the technology, the camera and everything, it's never quite the same. And all our views of God now are deficient compared to what they will be. It's like we have an image of him now, then the real thing. And so Paul is saying then that all these ways by which we know God, all these media, they will pass away. And that, by the way, is the issue. The issue is not which media will pass away between now and Christ's coming. Now, I think, and I will be developing this when I come to chapter 14, that there are some media which were for just a limited period within these last days. I think prophecy and tongue speaking were for a limited period before we had a complete Bible. That's not what Paul is talking about here. He's talking about this bigger issue that media generally are for these last days, and no more media will be required for knowing God when this age ends. We will know God directly. And whether it's tongues and prophecy on the one hand, whether it's the Bible on the other hand, whatever media you're talking about, none of them will be needed anymore on the day that we see our triune God. And Paul then is saying that love's not like that. Revelation will pass away, because revelation will give way to reality. Love will not pass away. By the way, there's another irony going on here, isn't there? That the Corinthians, we said a couple of weeks ago, the Corinthians thought that their speaking in tongues was a sign that they had made it, and they were now living on that kind of heavenly plane of existence, speaking in the tongues of angels. Paul is saying it's the opposite. The very fact you're speaking in tongues shows that we're not there. We're not yet there, because when we are, then we won't need tongues, we won't need prophecy, we won't need Bibles, we won't need any media like that. We'll have direct contact, exposure to the living God. But Paul is saying then that revelation will pass, love will not. Love is supreme, because it will always be. And in fact, he concludes in verse 13 that not only, therefore, is it greater than gifts like prophecy, speaking tongues, all the rest of it, it's even greater than those other two kind of cardinal virtues that we often lump together, faith, hope, and love. It's greater than faith and hope. Now, he says, we have all three of them. Because now, as well as love, we must have faith and we must have hope. But then, when that age comes, won't need faith anymore. Faith will turn into sight. Won't need hope anymore. What we hope for will have come. Love is the only eternal one of the three. Love will exist throughout those endless ages. Jonathan Edwards put it, heaven is a world of love. O Christ, he is the fountain, the deep, sweet well of love. Those streams on earth I've tasted, more deep I'll drink above. That's our future, isn't it? Swimming in this ocean of love, where love is unimpeded and unpolluted and is perfect and consummate. And that's why then it's so much more important than everything else. It's our future. It's this enduring reality once everything else has passed away. And so to come back then to the overall argument where we began, Paul is saying this. He's saying speaking in tongues is inferior because it doesn't necessarily function for the common good if it's not interpreted. But you won't understand the inferiority of speaking tongues until you understand, you Corinthians, that gifts are for the common good. But you won't understand that gifts are for the common good until you understand love. Love explains everything. And as we close tonight then, isn't there so much in our Bible that we won't appreciate until we understand 1 Corinthians 13, until we understand the all importance of love? I mean, I read from the Sermon on the Mount earlier on, and some of the things Jesus says there, I mean, they just seem so excessive, don't they? They seem over the top. The ethics he comes out with, the commands, the duties he imposes, they just seem to be so excessive. They don't make sense until you understand love. And there's so much of biblical teaching on how to live. So many commands, duties, responsibilities, exhortations only make sense when you understand 1 Corinthians 13, that love is so important. And so we need to be often coming to passages like this, soaking ourselves in what love is and praying that we might be a church that more and more manifests this love. Amen.